There are many problems today in general practice and in healthcare, but we are not going to dwell on those problems today. This area is well served. This is my response to Gandhi's 2015 article, A Further Blueprint for General Practice, produced by Gandhi and colleagues 6 years ago. It suggests solutions to the problems faced by general practice. So I'm going to reflect on what's moved on since 2015. I didn't contribute to the original article, so I'll be talking about what I like, what I don't like about it, and what I'd like to see change and also be added to bring it up to date to 2021. So let's get started. So let's get started and bring up the article. So this is from Gandhi's website, EGP Learning, just undergone a bit of a refresh and looking really nice and crisp. Here's the title of the article, and Gandhi sort of tees things up really and frames the need for a new direction and a new blueprint for general practice. Nice arguments there. Could read as a bit of a personal message to Jeremy Hunt, the then health secretary, and I'm sure that we could bring it up to date by adding some information about COVID, the challenges created, the responses that have been undertaken by general practice and other parts of the health service, and the ongoing challenges posed by COVID and the damage that that's brought to the society and the health service, increased demand, the need to catch up, and the experimentation with new access models that is having ramifications currently in terms of the access debate that's ongoing. So let's move forward and see what we think to these ideas. So idea one, produce and continuously monitor the activity levels of general practice, both demand and access. Well, this has sort of happened, I guess. The real-time monitoring of general practice activity and the publication of that activity on a dashboard is now part of the proposals from the government and part of the controversial Winter Access Fund letter. So almost case closed, but not quite, I guess. What will be published is activity. What is not considered is demand, which is the other part of this suggestion from Gandhi and his collaborators. And I think actually the publication of the demand element is crucial. It's in that difference between demand and activity where people are suffering and where services are feeling the stress. So, you know, in order to understand the picture fully, we must also measure and account for demand. It's a difficult thing to measure, but I think that it is vitally important if we're going to make sense of this access data that's going to come through. So I think that this is not fully met, and I would say that this stays in the blueprint. So idea two, increase remuneration and supply of GPs to enable them to have smaller patient lists and be able to maintain that activity level. So I think we're talking here about the remuneration levels to GPs to attract them into the practice, and also so that they can be present in sufficient numbers to look after the population well. Since 2015, I guess we've had inflation or less than inflation level rises in funding, where the demand and workload for that remuneration has increased much more and more steeply. And also new money coming into the sector has generally been tightly focused on new roles and not general practice, and also on additional activity. There have been some golden hello schemes. There have been some nods in the direction of improving remuneration, but it tends not to have found its way into recurrent funding streams for general practice and general practice pay and remuneration. I think this is still a really important part. General practice needs to remain attractive to medical graduates and to those people currently practicing general practice to keep them in the profession. And I think it's also a sign of desperation in the sector that myself and many of the GPs' priorities can now be just on making the job actually doable, rather than even asking for increased pay or pay that keeps up with inflation right now. Just look at how nearly all GPs cannot and or choose not to work full clinical weeks due to the additional demands and stressors. Effectively, those people are choosing a pay cut. They're still mostly working full-time, or what would be considered traditional full-time hours, don't get me wrong. You know, it's about working 50 hours over 3 or 4 days rather than, you know, 60 or 70 hours a week. These are the sorts of choices people are making. So I think remuneration for GPs, it's a difficult thing to ask for, but I think it is still important, and it needs to stay in the blueprint. The next section talks about making changes to control activity. Now, I'm totally on board with the concept of measures to control activity. I'm not sure how well the detail presented in this section of the blueprint sits within a document where most of the objectives are quite high level. The details points certainly speak to and will resonate with GPs and those working in the sector. But I wonder if possibly the public and other audiences that might see and we might want to be influenced by this blueprint might get lost in the weeds here. So I do wonder if I would trim this section. But just sort of taking each one in turn and seeing if there's anything to say directly to it. 3.1, allow only the prescription of prescription-only medicine items on NHS prescriptions. Prohibit pharmacists from selling treatments without a prescription at a higher price than can be obtained with a private prescription. Reevaluate the current criteria for free prescription entitlements, especially with regards to chronic health conditions. Create a national formulary for use by the NHS. Forbid priority to be given on the basis of a referral from NHS staff for any service or treatment not agreed by the GPC. For these 2 points, I'm not sure about the word forbid, actually. I'm not sure that that sounds friendly and forward looking. I might have picked something different, although I agree with the sentiment of what's being said. And 3.3, forbid advising people to consult their GP except if they are ill, believes themselves to be unwell, or for any other reason agreed by the GPC. I like this one, actually. Just reflecting on it, if any podcast or YouTube video such as this, or magazine or newspaper article or TV or radio program wants to discuss a health issue and then absolve themselves of the risk of the consequences or distress or harm that they might have caused through the discussion of that issue, then all they have to and all they do say is, if you have any concerns, please talk to your GP. And a significant amount of people at a national level do go and see their GP, you know, the next morning or the next Monday morning after they've seen something at the weekend to talk about those issues. And it does place demand on the system. You know, people and organizations do these things and make these programs and write these articles. Okay, sometimes they are trying to help. Sometimes they are raising important health issues that might otherwise go unnoticed. So they do a service, but sometimes they're just looking to get attention. Sometimes they are looking to sell things such as advertising on their platforms. You know, they do get something from it. And sometimes the discussion is framed in a controversial way. They do not have to deal with the costs of mopping up any of that because they outsource it to general practice. So I like this one. It might be difficult to enforce to stop people using general practice as the risk sink for them discussing anything controversial or discussing anything distressing, but I would like to see that. 3.5, allow GPs only to consult in approved premises except when treating those who are housebound and in the terminal phase of an illness. That all sounds very reasonable. I think the bottom line here in section 3 is that there is value in reviewing what we want and what we need our GP surgeries and general practice to be doing outside of the core role of assessment and treatment of people who are or believe themselves to be unwell. And also to place some limits on these additional asks and, you know, removing perhaps some of the existing asks that are there within the system as well. I think rather than going into so much detail, I think that's what I would ask for, and then let the detail fall out of that process of reviewing the activity and choosing to place some things out of scope for general practice. Moving on to idea 4. Instead of capitation-based funding, offer activity-based funding to those GPs with minimum list size determined on the basis of predicted need. And I might go as far as to bring activity-based funding into play for all GPs. I think making the distinction of who is eligible for it at their practice and who isn't might be difficult. So broadly speaking, I'm actually very supportive of this point. The blueprint does point out that there is currently limited flat funding per patient per year for providing all of the care that people need and get from their general practice. And this figure is surprisingly low. It has gone up a little bit from 2015, but it's probably still in the realms of, you know, insuring your hamster for veterinary care, or a very limited subscription to paid for television, such as perhaps if you just had the Netflix and the Amazon Prime, for example. Now, when I see discharges from the emergency department, they are itemized, and you can see how much the department is paid for each component of care given, the taking of observations, blood tests done, ECGs, imaging or x-rays that they've done, providing of dressings, providing of treatments. And it all adds up to quite a lot, actually. In general practice, it's just a flat fee for everything, regardless of how much healthcare someone consumes in a year. If the system allowed funding to follow activity and for activity to follow demands, then the resources can and could flow to where they are needed most. And those resources can pay for the staff needed in those places. In effect, pulling the recruitment of more GPs and other practice staff and other resources into where they are most needed, using market forces to ensure that supply moves to where the demand is and that the supply keeps up with that demand. However, I can see the problem here. This point may not be popular with the government. Currently, if there are spikes or even relentless gradual increases in demand, as we have seen over the past few decades, then GP practices and the partners within them who hold the fixed cost contracts do carry the risk of paying for this increased activity, regardless of whether it's fueled by them, the government, or just a naturally aging population, as is the case for all of these things, really. On an item of service-based contract that is proposed here, that risk for increased activity shifts from the provider to the commissioner, the person paying for the service, and in this case that's the government, and they would need to pay more to meet increasing demand, or take measures to reduce that demand, or take measures to reduce the scope of the offer provided to control costs. And that's something that might be quite unpopular for the government to do. So this is a difficult one to deliver, but I think it would solve a lot of the access and supply and recruitment and workforce issues within general practice if this were allowed to happen. Idea five, allow GPs to be covered by Crown indemnity reimbursement of indemnity. So essentially, this has happened. So check. And thank you, Gandhi, for raising this. And I'm sure others did as well. And this has actually happened. And actually, we're very grateful for this in general practice. In hospital, people have always been covered by what is known as Crown indemnity. So if an error happens in hospital and there are damages to be paid, then generally this is paid by the NHS and consultants and staff operating hospitals. For most of their activity, did not and have never had to take out additional insurance. This wasn't the case for general practice, and we had to take out individual additional insurance policies to cover our activity. And these were becoming increasingly expensive as litigation increased over the years. But thankfully, for the most part, most general practice activity has now moved under Crown indemnity, as it is in hospital. And that's a real, that's really great progress. So thanks, Gandhi, and thanks for everyone else that raised that and made it happen. Idea six, amalgamate the GMC speciality and GP registrars, registers. So this is really about increasing the status of GPs by putting them on a par with consultants as a speciality, as recognized by the GMC. I think this can only be a positive thing. Other generalist specialities, such as geriatrics and pediatrics, are considered specialities, so why not GP? I think this would increase the attractiveness of general practice as a career for medical graduates to go into, and that can only be a positive thing. Idea seven, exclude general practice from the NHS. So this is quite big, almost sounds like a nuclear option. Very interesting, and actually I really love that this is here. This essentially puts privatization of GP surgeries on the table. General practice and general practices operate as private partnerships in any case. So it would be quite simple for them to hand back their NHS contracts and start seeing people privately instead. Well, maybe not quite that simple. It would be dreadful for people who might struggle to afford private primary care, and dreadful for health equity and health inequalities. But it would be nowhere near as complex as privatizing secondary care in hospitals, for example, where everybody is an employee of a hospital trust, and the hospital trust is the government body that owns the property, etc. There will be some complexity, and in particular around what to do about premises and reimbursable rent, or at least how to replace that income for practices. But I don't think it's insurmountable. The reason I like that this is here is not necessarily that I'm in favour of this measure, but I think sometimes in order to shift a debate along in the direction that you need it to go, it helps to talk about extreme options. This is something that I've learned over the last few years, and I've learned that it's called moving Overton's window, which I think is a sort of journalistic term. In any case, Overton's window for any issue represents those views that are considered reasonable, and reasonable to talk about and reasonable to suggest. But you can shift Overton's window in one direction or the other, or widen it by deliberately talking about the previously unspeakable options. So if, for example, you start talking pragmatically about the privatization of GP services, then suddenly item of service or payment by activity suggestions begin to sound much more reasonable and come into play. So I like that this is here. I think it's probably tactical, but I like that it's there. So that's the end of the document. And I like the blueprint, with perhaps some zooming out of the detail in section three, controlling the activities section. But I would add a few things. So what would I add? So idea eight, suggestion, limited liability options for partners. So allow traditional partnerships to convert to limited liability partnerships or other limited liability business structures. Now, this might sound a bit technical to some, but I think it's really, really important. GP partnerships operate under traditional partnership law. This is law passed in the 1840s, I believe. And this means that if there's a failure of a GP surgery and the organization has liabilities, including debts, say, on unpaid compensation for an employment tribunal or redundancies of staff or debts to landlords, then the GP partners are personally liable and may have to sell their personal assets, including car or cars and homes, or become personally bankrupt in order to pay these liabilities. And this is simply Victorian, in my opinion. And there are other ways that GP partnerships could be permitted to structure their businesses in order to avoid this. I would first look in the direction of the limited liability partnership structures used by law and accountancy firms that don't place their partners in this position and limit the liabilities that they have to and within the business. This issue, I think, is part of why it's harder and harder to recruit GP partnerships these days. You know, business failures used to be really, really rare, and there used to be very few circumstances where that could conceivably happen. But now, with CQC and the ability to close down practices, you know, enhanced employment law and employment law liabilities, property issues, difficulty recruiting for sustainability for the business, it's really possible that GP surgeries fold now. You know, and it's a much more likely event to happen now than it was even just, say, 10 years ago. So I think that that would be an important thing to be within the blueprint. And finally, just one more idea. Idea nine, an office for budget responsibility for health data and health planning. So honesty and the independent verification of data and planning documents and forecasts for general practice and the rest of the NHS, I think would help so much with planning healthcare and the public debate around healthcare. When the Chancellor of the Exchequer publishes his budget twice a year, the Independent Office of Budget Responsibility checks his figures, checks his working, and makes independent predictions about the impact of those changes that are suggested. The same is needed for health. There is so much confusion about simple things, such as how many GPs or other staff that there are, were in the past and will be in the future, and what impact various plans will have on this. And health policy is so much more complex than that. We just need better data and analysis to make the best decisions around health policy, planning and spending. And I think that between NICE and the established practices from bodies such as the Office of Budget Responsibility, we have the expertise to make this happen. Perhaps what's lacking is the political will. The NHS and general practice is just an irresistible political football. But I think in order to make real process and have grown-up planning discussions around healthcare, this needs to happen. And it's interesting to note that Jeremy Hunt, the target of the original 2015 blueprint, is now calling for this in his role in the Health Scrutiny Committee. And isn't that just so strange and interesting? So what do you think? Do you agree with the blueprint? What else should be in the blueprint? Please let us know via the usual channels. And as ever, hopefully we've helped you tech enhance your primary care and learning.
Oh, hello there, EGP learner. I'm Dr. Gandalf, and I often get asked, what kind of resources do you have to try and help those using EMIS? Because you tend to do a lot more stuff for System 1. And often I've really struggled to answer that question, because let's be honest, I don't use EMIS on a regular basis. So therefore, trying to help EMIS users is a little bit more difficult for myself. And that really made me feel, well, not great. So I kind of did something to try and help all those EMIS users out there. I went and had a chat with one of my colleagues, Dr. Mike from GP on the Move, and him and I have created a course that you can use to help you use EMIS so much better. That's right, if you use EMIS but you want to use it so much better, so much quicker, and in such a way that means you go home sooner, then check out our EMIS for Clinicians course. It's an online course that takes you through all the tips and tricks that Dr. Mike knows to try and basically mean you can go home quicker. That'd be a cool thing, wouldn't it? And guess what? It's currently on offer. So if you want to take advantage of this introductory offer and get access to it now, look at the links down below and check it out. Additionally, if you're a practice, network, or wide area that wants more opportunity to use it, send me an email, egplearning@gmail.com. Let's see if we can help you out. And as I like to say, to tech enhance your primary care and learning. Shall we get back to it? Oh, and if you wanted one for System 1 users, well, you know I've got you covered, haven't I? Check out the Learn System 1 for Clinicians course, bit.ly/TPP S1 course.